So welcome, everybody. My name is Dr. Andrew Treseda. This is our health and self-care broadcast, and I'm joined by my colleague and friend as co-presenter,
Dr. Peter Bagshaw, GP in Somerset.
And it gives us great pleasure to welcome back Dr. Karen Forshaw and Chrissy Mowbray, published authors on How to Rise, to talk today about imposter syndrome. Karen and Chrissy, would you like to introduce yourselves, please?
Hi there, I'm Karen Forshaw. I'm a GP in South Yorkshire. I think that self-awareness and self-improvement is something that I think is really important for each of us as individuals. And it's something that I try to talk to my patients about, particularly because actually, often people can kind of heal themselves in a way, can't they? Or people have great power that they are not using. And I think it's great to empower people and improve their knowledge and allow them to grow as people, really. So that's my kind of style of consulting.
That's very exciting. We have a title that we're going to talk to, but I think there's much more that we could explore as well. So, Chrissy.
Hi, I'm Chrissy Mowbray. I am a physiotherapist, psychotherapist, hypnotherapy trainer and hypnotherapist, and a shamanic practitioner, amongst other things. And I think my sort of definition of resilience is about understanding what triggers us, understanding what makes our kind of cognitive behavioral cycles drive into an unconscious place, and to be able to show up with all of those triggers present and to actually choose to be okay in the presence, because then you're empowered, you're bulletproof, aren't you? If you have to have the world behave a certain way for you to be okay, then you're giving the power to the world to kind of crush you. Whereas if you choose to be okay and the world can do what it likes, I think if we can learn these things for ourselves, we become kind of super people, don't we?
Gosh, lots already for us to think about. So just nailing down the definition, what would be your definition of imposter syndrome?
Can I take that, Christine?
Please do.
Long definition. So this is where we call ourselves science and spirit, and I'm the science person, which actually that's not true. We're both, aren't we? But I do love definitions. So for me, imposter syndrome is all about people holding limiting beliefs of not being good enough. And we think that the majority of people actually have a deep underlying belief of not being good enough or not being worthy. And that's something that drives a lot of our negative thinking, our negative emotions, and any negative behaviours that we engage in.
And Chrissy, you called yourself a shamanic practitioner in your introduction. That, I'm absolutely fascinated by that. What variety of shaman are you? What is a shamanic practitioner, please?
My lineage, in that the person who taught me, she trained in Peru with the Shipibo people. But if you look into shamanic practice, it has it is very similar across the world. So whichever culture you go to, there will be use of kind of natural drum skins and rattles, and we use these natural elements to bring up our stuff. So just a little example of that is, if we were doing a sound bath and there was a rattle I was using that would be very irritating, it would bring up all the things that have been irritating me. So all of that emotional sort of stuff comes up and is available for us to be able to shift. I'm also really interested in the Toltec shamanism as well, because that's the Don Miguel Ruiz kind of side of things. And all of the reason why it's so interesting and so important here is that most of our modern psychotherapy has its roots there. We know about these ancient principles, and we've kind of sanitized them and made them kind of acceptable. We've done a lot of research in the West, but really it comes back to a deep-rooted intuition about what's needed, and it has less of a kind of it's not as compartmentalized. So you would go to see a shaman about your debts or your marriage problems or your physical ailments, and it was much less kind of compartmentalized, as I say, and it just aligns with the clinical work that I do so well. And it's also personal interest, so it's that kind of, you are the healer, isn't it?
It sounds as though it's not shamanism is, or the practice is not problem solving, but it's much more empowering the person, because so often in life we give away our power into a situation or to another person. And I know that some traditions talk about soul loss or bits of soul loss, and there's something about taking back your power or taking back
bits. I do hypnotherapeutic technique for trauma, which is inner child work, but I actually call it soul retrieval now, because that's what it's called in shamanism. And to me, that feels like a much more, a much better way of describing it. Go on, Andrew, what did you want to say?
Well, I was going to ask Karen, I'm loving what you're saying. It's really fascinating, Chrissy. Karen, as the scientist, open inverted commas, please comment.
Okay. So I think what Chrissy says is these things are still there. Yep. So when I say to people, you know, when we think about Adler, who was a contemporary of Freud, and he said, it's not what happens to us, it's what we make of it, basically, isn't it? So if we choose to see a trauma as an opportunity to learn, rather than framing it as a trauma, then actually we recover from it in a much more positive way. I teach that to my patients, but actually Epictetus said that, and he was a Greek philosopher. So these messages are ancient, really, and we are just all saying the same thing, just in different languages.
Yeah. I think it's 2,000 years old, isn't it? The what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was doing some research on this, and it's very interesting that they think that actually being exposed to low-level stresses actually builds up our ability to deal with really bad stuff when it comes along. And that endless sort of trying to keep away from anything that's at all stressful is actually counterproductive. I don't know if you'd agree with that, both of you.
I would also say that when you're doing the work, there's a lot of sort of fake spirituality is a bit of a harsh thing to say, but the love and light sort of, we have to feel comfortable all the time, we have to feel nurtured all the time. Actually, the discomfort is where the growth is, and most of us try to squash it or, you know, deny it. And I think that's a dangerous thing, because we're not processing the emotions, and then it comes back as trauma. Whereas actually, if you sit with the discomfort, your body is telling you there's something really important to learn here. And if you don't want to feel discomfort again, then process it, learn it, clear it, shift it. And you can do that in lots of ways with the modern psychotherapy, you can do it with hypnotherapy, and there's the shamanic, but it's all the same stuff. It's where you access it, where you're comfortable, and what works for you.
It's funny, isn't it? We've become averse to any sort of discomfort now in our modern life. And yet, if we want to get physically stronger, we're quite comfortable with the concept that our muscles have to ache a little bit to actually improve. So to me, it's the same sort of thing in a psychological way. I don't know if you agree.
We embrace the discomfort. Yeah, when Karen and I teach shadow work, we always say it's quite uncomfortable, but actually we embrace it. If something's uncomfortable, you're about to learn or grow or purge something. It's really quite an exciting thing, isn't it? That you think, oh, this feels really icky. Let's explore it. And then it's gone. And the more you look at it, the less uncomfortable it feels. So yeah, we always like to work in those areas.
I heard of an ago, another growth opportunity, and not another growth opportunity.
Let's not have them all at once.
Exactly. So imposter syndrome, is this something that fits with only one demographic? Is it something that we have at school or at university? Is it something that professionals have?
I think everybody has it.
Everybody has it.
To be honest, I think it's a fairly universal thing in degrees. But when you take really kind of highly stressful jobs, people potentially who are, perfectionists, those kinds of people will are at risk of developing it more, really. So I think it does sit in medical professions, in the kind of highly stressful, any profession actually, where there's lots of stress and lots of a feeling of a need to succeed. That's essentially where it comes from.
And I'm experienced. Sorry, Peter, carry on.
Sorry, Andrew. it's certainly something I experience every day of my professional career. And coming back to what we were saying earlier, I wonder if actually it can be a positive thing, in that if we know that we have these high expectations that we may not be able to meet, that's actually understanding the nature of the pressure. If we think we can do it and we're fine, we don't feel imposters, that's when we're riding for a fall.
Potentially, yeah, I agree with you. And actually, there's some research that says that mild imposter syndrome is good for us because it drives us to work harder and do better. But I think if you have to get to the root of it, because that's where we sit. We like to really dig down into where does imposter syndrome actually come from. But if it's coming from a deep-seated negative core belief of not being good enough, that is going to influence every thought, feeling, and behaviour that you engage in, which will have huge impact on what you manifest around you. Yeah, because we do impact what happens around us by the things that we say, by the things that we do, by the way that we show our emotions to people, because we're showing how we feel all the time, even if we think we're not, don't we? So we will be manifesting all the time, and if that's coming from a place of negativity, then we're going to manifest negativity. So actually, when we recognize imposter syndrome in ourselves, we need to challenge that belief, because it's a harmful belief, really, or it's a limiting belief, and when we limit ourselves, that's sad, isn't it?
And do limiting beliefs come from the exams we do as teenagers or at university, or do they come from further back?
I'll let Chrissy take that one.
Oh, they come from our survival instinct, don't they? That when we're born, we're helpless, aren't we? So and we're looking for approval, because approval is the opposite of being abandoned. So if somebody says, yes, I approve of you, you're in, we're not going to get left on a hill to die. So actually, right from birth, we are looking to be approved of, to be liked, to be told we're good at something, to be told there's a niche, there's something that we have a talent for. Then if you think of it in a tribal way, we're acceptable because we're the one who can do this job. And all of that contributes to a sense of safety. And we are seeking that sense of safety throughout our lives. And right at the bottom of that, there's this insidious worry that we are not going to make the grade, that we're not good enough. And it turns into a belief because we say it often enough. And every time there's a failure, you see, you're not good enough. You have to try harder. You have to do better. And that's what drives us. But also that repetition is negative self-talk. So if we're going into a job interview saying, you see, you're not good enough, remember, you are not going to be able to find the words, and you will be showing that you're not good enough. You might even say, you might be apologizing for, oh yeah, you know, I've only got this qualification, or I've not been doing it that long. And actually you're giving the impression of not being good enough, which is going to affect how people see you, and potentially you won't get that job. Whereas if you're faking it till you make it, almost, if you actually go in there and make, if you live as if you are good enough, if you are actually, you will manifest that, because people will see that you're already doing the job, you're already walking around like you've got the role. And so people are much likely to have confidence in you. So you manifest that success with the belief at the heart of it.
That's really interesting, Chrissy. So like so many other things, it goes back to childhood. As we see time and time again. You talked about Freud. Now, he believed that just sort of uncovering these things and understanding what had gone on would make them disappear. And we know that's sadly not the case. So you've both got formidable toolkits to deal with this. So recognizing where it comes from, how do we get rid of it?
Okay. So actually, we have a worksheet. We have a worksheet about this. So how do we... really, what we need to do is recognize the negative core beliefs, yeah, that we're holding, the limiting beliefs that we're holding. And we can do that by observing our thoughts. And if we notice negative patterns of thinking and negative narrative that's going on in our head all the time, then we can ask ourselves, according to whom? Yeah. And sometimes you can trace that back. You know, it might be because somebody said something to you as a child. And you can actually then metaphorically give that belief back. Yep. If you can't find the origin, that's okay. You actually then challenge the limiting belief and say, is that true? Yeah, is that actually true? And you can look for evidence for and against the belief that you keep repeating to yourself over and over again. And actually, you can decide, no, there's no evidence for this belief. Therefore, this is an irrational belief. It's not helping me, and I need to discard it. And then we actually need to learn to then create much more expansive beliefs. But I will let Chrissy talk about, because we said we weren't going to.
Before asking Chrissy, can I just pick up on that? I love the is it true? Cognitively, we can know that something is untrue, but we can still have a feeling inside. And for me, when I'm exploring this, it'll sometimes come up as an inner five-year-old or three-year-old. I'm not good enough. What? I want my mummy. Or whatever that should be. So there's an emotionally laden core belief somewhere behind. And I don't know that cognition always sorts out the emotion that's unresolved, but I'm happy to be corrected. Or are there other toolkits and tools that you can use to help?
Perfect. There are other toolkits you can use to help. So cognitively or consciously, it's underlying in the subconscious, isn't it? Because it's there as a safety mechanism, and that safety survival mechanism is primal. So it's there driving everything, and it's very difficult to get to it. So you sometimes need a little bit of help. And there are several ways to get to the subconscious. One of them is to have somebody in authority say it to you. So if a teacher told you you're rubbish at maths, you are likely to believe it. Or a parent tells you that you're rubbish at something, you're likely to believe it. So actually, there is a lot of merit in becoming the authority on yourself. And you are, aren't you? You know more about yourself than anybody else. So you can actually become the expert and become the authority and to say that to yourself, but also affirmation and repetition. So to create a belief that is simply worded, that is true, that is present, that is emotive, and to say it over and over again, to write it down, to put it in places where you'll see it on, and repetition for the subconscious. And remember how many times we repeat the negative self stuff. We say, you're so stupid. I can't believe you've done that. You'll never be able to achieve that. You're not going to hit that deadline. That's repetition. So we have to counteract that. Seek out evidence, as Karen has said. Behave as if it's true, because that will give you a similar body chemistry. So if you behave, whether you feel it or not, you walk around like you're the boss, then people will behave differently towards you, and it will change the body chemistry. Meditation is good, because altered states of awareness as well will. So if you take yourself in with that affirmation into an altered state of awareness and say it to yourself there. Emotional freedom technique, tapping, EFT, EMDR therapy as well, and hypnotherapy. So again, all altered states of awareness.
Yes.
Because when we're bypassing the conscious, then we're bypassing the cognitive, and we're going straight into the belief system with those altered states. And if we're going in there with a true, well-worded affirmation, then we're more likely to get into the subconscious and change the belief.
Chrissy, you used a couple of acronyms there. Can I ask you to unpack them, please?
Yes, I
EMDR
will.
And EFT.
EMDR, eye movement.
Desensitization.
Desensitization, that's right. So that's it's the watch, isn't it? And actually, there's a lot of controversy around, is this an altered state of awareness? And they say it's not, but I actually disagree with that, because I think that the eye movement does create an altered state, but there's a very definite trajectory with that. Emotional freedom technique is the tapping on the acupuncture points that helps to emotionally process, and you change. It's involved with the IQs as well. So when you're speaking to somebody and they're retrieving memories from certain places, or if they're constructing answers, their eyes will go into different places. Yes. And it's very quick. We've been doing this on the hypnotherapy and the EFT. It sort of recites where those things are, so that they're not connected to the emotions anymore. So those are the acronyms.
Can I give a conjectural theory?
Please.
So this is partly from Ian McGilchrist's work on the divided brain, but the right hemisphere, he says, and he doesn't mean anatomically the right hemisphere, but the right hemisphere function is to know the world as it is and to just understand it as it is. The left hemisphere wants to understand about it, deconstructs, and I think that probably we get open inverted commas, true representation of reality in the right hemisphere's understanding, but then we process it through the left. And if we get an emotional block at that point of fear or shame or distress or whatever, we fail to integrate the learning from both sides. And so we end up with an emotionally laden, stuck bit. And using sort of computer analogies, it's as though there's a program or something on the computer, a bit of the software that's out of tune. And essentially it needs retuning by one of the techniques. And EMDR is not just the eye movement. It actually, there's lateralization techniques that are they're using your hands and cross body states, which is helping reintegrate left and right.
The R
is for reprocessing.
Reprocessing.
But, and at the end of your EFT, you're actually using eye movement for the same thing because you're moving things around in terms of, so you access things with the eye movement, but when you're doing EFT, you actually move the eyes on purpose and you use the numerical and the lyrical part of the brain so that you're actually changing where it's sighted.
We're going to have a talk on EFT at some point. Peter.
As the resident skeptic, as regular listeners may know, can I ask what's the evidence base for these different interventions and how do people access them? Are they available on the NHS in the way that CBT is?
Yeah, so EMDR absolutely is. So you can access that. People who've got post-traumatic stress disorder will be treated using EMDR. I mean, where I work, it's through the local talking therapies kind of organisation. So that's not even secondary care. That's in the primary care sector. EFT, I think there's evidence for it, but it's not available on the NHS. So that would be something that people would access in privately, really, if they wanted to.
Having said that, I quite agree, Karen. I've used EFT myself for 20 years and found it powerful. And there is one NHS organisation which I know of who employs an EFT therapist and has had some tremendous responses on trauma with some of their frontline staff. So this person after a pilot is now employed because it helps keep people in work and put them back
fantastic.
To work.
Fantastic. I know, because I know you work with NHS Practitioner Health, don't you, Andrew? And I know one of your colleagues and she does EFT as well. It's definitely something that we should be looking into. This is a bit like where we were with CBT, kind of 30 years ago, isn't it, when everybody was a bit skeptical and thought that it was that really we should just be using medication. But cognitive behavioral therapy is now first line treatment for mild to moderate depression and actually is as good as, if not better than, medication, really. So, which hence why talking therapies, that's where we refer everybody to.
They also advocate a combination of treatments in terms of CBT combined with hypnotherapy is incredible because you're bypassing the conscious and you're actually working in the subconscious. So you can pick up people's narratives, their limiting beliefs, and you can look at the cycles and then you use that in an altered state of awareness to reprogram.
So thank you, that's really helpful. So probably many of us have imposter syndrome, and certainly when I've talked about it in the workplace, the prevalence seems to be about 70% that people have either have it or have had it at some point or other. If we do our inner work, which is what you're suggesting, to work on these core beliefs, to work on who we are, then we've got quite a good chance of transcending it, of healing it, of moving beyond it, or we just sit with it and we're stuck. Is that a plea for us all to take ourselves seriously rather than just do the day job, as it were?
I think so. So instead of every time you catch yourself saying I'm so stupid, just ask yourself, would you say that to your child? Yeah, would you say that to a colleague? Would you say that to a friend? No. So please stop saying that to yourself. Yeah. And just change that to I am adaptable. I am capable. I am whole and I am worthy. Yeah. And the more that we say those things to ourselves, the better we will become as people, the more positive we will be in all aspects of our life, and therefore the more we will manifest positivity around us and we'll all be happy.
That's win-win for everybody, isn't it? Fascinating.
I think it's important to say, when you say would you say it to a child, actually when you're doing the inner child work and the soul retrieval, you are saying it because you are still that child that had the experience of being told you weren't good enough and it felt terrible. So you drove things into the deep, into the recesses of the shadow. And we become a kind of we run away from those parts of ourselves that feel vulnerable and stupid and not good enough. And we kind of put on a persona that feels like we're crushing it. But when you say you're stupid, you are saying it to that child version of self, and it feels awful. Go on, Andrew.
Interesting. No, just to pick up on that, it's as though we are still wearing a tight brown coat or whatever colour that we were wearing age 5 or 6 or 3 or young. And sometimes just using that metaphor, using that image, is enough for people to say, do I still have to hold on to this way of being? Because whenever I see my father or my mother, even though I'm in my 40s or my 50s, I retreat into a state, even though they are now old people.
And actually, we are adults now. And if when you do the soul retrieval, you go back and speak to that child version of self and say, hang on a minute, it's not what you think it is. And I'm going to parent you now, and I'm going to champion you, and I'm going to tell you, because I've survived it all and I've got the tools, and there's nobody who deserves it more than you. And you reparent yourself and you take responsibility for those young parts of self. So instead of saying you're so stupid, I knew you wouldn't be able to do it, you're saying, actually, no, I'm not having that anymore. Whoever told you that was wrong. And I can tell you the truth because I know more about you than anybody else. And it's how you take responsibilities for those vulnerable parts of self, and you bring them into the present moment, and you arrive whole in your job, and you know that you're capable.
Gosh, you make inner work sound so simple. Why aren't we all doing it?
It is. Sorry, I'm interrupting, but when we say it's hard to do that work, we don't do it, do we?
And again, that's a limiting belief.
Interesting.
I think it's the discomfort as well, and the feeling that we're going to have to work hard and that it's going to be uncomfortable makes us say, oh, I can't though, I've got X, Y, Z to do. But when you do it, we celebrate that whole, ugh, it's uncomfortable, but I feel better because that wasn't that bad.
And that is interesting, because so often we want to self-soothe, rather, which is actually palliative rather than go for healing, which is you work through the discomfort, sit with it and move through. And they say that under pressure, the yang invades another country or drinks alcohol, the yin goes shopping or eats chocolate. So the four mechanisms that we self-soothe are projection, it's all your fault, blot out, substances or alcohol. What were the other two? Under pressure, projection, blot out, distraction or comfort behaviour. I'm sorry, I lost my thread there.
They're all sticking plasters, aren't they?
They're all sticking plasters.
Exactly. I'd just say if you're feeling discomfort, for me, it's if you do it, you don't have to feel it again. So for me, I don't have to feel this again if I just sit with it now.
Yes. Otherwise, it's coming back again and again and again. Peter.
Yeah. We're coming towards the end of our time, unfortunately. So that's been a fascinating journey and something that... I hadn't really thought about it in the sort of depth that you both covered it. So I'm very grateful for that. Now, for people listening who think, yes, I recognize this, maybe I do have to do a bit of hard work, even though it's going to be uncomfortable. What resources can you tell people about that they should get in touch with to try and address these issues?
So I think they should read our book, which is called How to Rise. I think that would be a marvellous resource.
Where's that available? We're going to put it on the show notes, but could you just tell us the details again so people know about that?
So it's called How to Rise, a Complete Resilience Manual, and it's available at Waterstones on Amazon. I think you get the best deal on Amazon, actually.
Do we have to declare that you make money from this? Or
you might have to
publish book.
Peter, I think we're all published authors, and we all know that actually none of us have written million-pound murder mysteries or blockbusters.
We do also have a free website, actually, which people are very welcome to access. And there are hundreds and hundreds of articles on there. And all of the articles have a tool at the end of them because we're very how-to. So actually there is information on there about challenging limiting beliefs and creating more expansive ones. So
we'll put it on the website, on the show notes. But your website address is
www.resilientpractice.co.uk.
Thank you very much.
Lovely. Gosh, half an hour has absolutely flown by. I found this session completely fascinating. And Peter, we're very grateful to Karen and Chrissy for giving up their time to share with our listeners. I think really quite an in-depth look at the deeper drivers behind imposter syndrome and what we can do about them, and how probably it's not that difficult if we start.
Absolutely. No, easy peasy. Yeah, just be prepared to look. That's all it is.
Very exciting.
Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed, both. And thank you to Andrew and to our listeners. And do you wish to wrap up, Andrew, as you're our host?
Well, thank you to everyone. And to our listeners, go well.